This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week we are featuring mentalist Richard Osterlin on the Magic Word Podcast. He has been performing magic for well over 40 years professionally around the world and has so many products out. In fact, he says that he has more DVDs out than any other mentalist. And that's saying a lot because I know a lot of guys have got things out like Max Maven and others. But he's been after it for a long time and has been performing. And, well, when I first saw him actually was at a comedy club here in the at the Improv in Houston many years ago. And we talk a little bit about that at the beginning of this podcast. But Richard and I had worked together at the East Coast Mind Jam a couple of years ago, and he will be performing again this year and giving a workshop at the East Coast Mind Jam. And that's going to be from June 24th through the 26th here of 2016 in Somerset, New Jersey. More information on that is at eastcoastmindjam.com. Well, I have a lot of respect for this man, and he has, again, accomplished so much, and he has a lot of really good ideas, many of which that I have tried and things I have incorporated in some of my own performances. And he can certainly talk about theory for hours, and he can also talk about tricks for hours. And in fact, that it was during a Penguin lecture, I believe a while back, maybe last year or so, that his lecture went on for 5 hours. Yeah, I mean, the guy can talk, and it's all good, solid stuff that you'd want to stay with it. I wish we had more time, but we kept this under an hour. And also that he has offered his newest DVD, which is called Eerie, which is a 2-set DVD that is available through his website at osterlinmysteries.com. And we will be telling you about how that you can register to win a copy of this 2-CD set. Or rather, two DVD set at the back end of this podcast. I find myself apologizing again for the quality of the sound for this podcast. There is not any ambient noise in the background. Unfortunately, though, that the Wi-Fi that Richard has in Kentucky is not very good, so we couldn't do a Skype call, so we just did it over the telephone. And so it sounds like what it is, that is me talking over Skype and calling him on his phone while he's sitting at home. So it does sound like a phone conversation, but you're still able to understand everything that he says. It's just not the quality that I would prefer. So I apologize up front for that, but the quality of the information is pure gold. So let me back out of the way and introduce our guest, Richard Osterlin, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I am glad to welcome as my guest a good friend and someone that you guys probably know or should know, Mr. Richard Osterlin. Hey there, Richard.
How you doing, Scott? Good to talk to you.
And as you as well. Thank you very much. I'm doing fantastic, and I'm glad you're available, and we're talking to you. You're in Kentucky. Is that where you live now?
That's where I'm at. Yep. I've been here for about 15 years now.
Okay, because I remember I thought originally you were from the East Coast, like Connecticut, I believe, or someplace. Is that right?
That's correct. I lived in Connecticut until I moved out here. So those are the two places I've lived.
Yeah, just those two places all your life. I guess when I first got to know you, it was through Richard Hatch, our mutual acquaintance, and I guess he had lived out there with or near you. Is that right, way back when?
Yeah, that Richard... I believe at the time, I don't want to get the story wrong, but I thought the story was that he was originally going to be studying at Yale, and then and his wife, Rosemary, played with the symphonic orchestra, but then he turned his attention to magic. So I'm not sure exactly what happened, if he completed what he was planning to do or not. They lived in New Haven for a while, and we got to be very close friends. And as a matter of fact, he was the one responsible. You know, I talk about it in my books. I worked at the Marriott Hotel for about, oh, my goodness, 6 years or so, doing the Sunday brunches, elaborate Sunday brunch. And that's where I made a lot of good contacts, corporate contacts, because the Marriott was right off Route 84 outside of Hartford in a little town called Farmington. But it was a beautiful Marriott hotel that had a lot of corporate events there. But a lot of people would stay there when they had business in Hartford, and the Sunday brunch was elaborate. Way back then, I think it was somewhere around, $25 to $30 a piece, but you walked into this room, which was a gorgeous room, two rooms, actually. I remember one part of it, one wall was completely an aquarium with all kinds of exotic fish, and the room was just incredible. I mean, it looked like you were walking to the Great Gatsby or something. And every possible food you could imagine was sitting there. And you came in, you sat down, the first thing that happened, the waiter came along and poured you a glass of mimosa, and you were good to go. And I used to perform there every Sunday from 10 o'clock in the morning till about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So he had the gig originally, and then when he moved away, he gave it to me, and that's how I got it in the first place.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, back then in the 70s, $25, $30 for a brunch was pretty high priced.
Yeah, very high priced. Yeah. You got your money. You got your money for it, though.
Dick was the one who had introduced me then to you, because when I got to know Richard here in Houston, he was telling me one time, I remember, that you were coming through on a comedy club and said, hey, let's go over to the Improv. Richard's going to be doing mentalism. And I didn't know you or much about you. Of course, he had talked you up, and Richard's a good friend, so I said, I'm in. So we went, and that's whenever I remember seeing you and doing your the thing that I remember most was the Q&A routine that you did. But I thought, let me kind of back up a little bit from just in saying, I thought it unusual to have a mentalist at a comedy club, which is atypical. I was thinking, again, this would have been in the 80s sometime. I don't remember approximately when, but you might have a better recollection of that date around that time. But I thought, usually it's somebody who's going to be just, 15 laughs per minute or something. I hadn't really typically thought of a mentalist as being a comedian who would hold that spot in a comedy club. But I was, obviously, it was something that I remember still to this day, your performance. It was very entertaining. And again, the Q&A and the little pad that you made, and you later taught how to make the thing. So just did a great job.
Yeah, I remember that now. We had a real good time, and that was a fun time. You're bringing back memories from many, many years ago. I think that's also might have been when I first met Danicek. I'm not quite sure, but I think that might have been
I believe you're right. Because he was Steve Shaw, and he and I were working at the Magic Island together, and that would have been about 86, 87, somewhere, I think, in there.
Yeah.
And that's when Dick said, hey, and so, yeah, the three of us came down to see you.
Yeah, that was a fun time. I do remember this, though, on not so good side. I thought New York driving was bad, and then I got to Houston, and it's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, all times, the day and night, too. That's what I always, when I was on the Magic Island, we get off at like 1 or 2 in the morning after a long night, and I think all this traffic coming from, I mean, this time of the morning, I mean, should these people be at home? I mean, it's amazing still in that late.
That was crazy. I don't think I've been back in Houston, but I don't think I've ever been back driving. I stay away from that.
Well, now, were you doing comedy clubs as a circuit? I mean, on the circuit, doing this tour, or did this as a one-off to come here and do the Improv and then back out?
Well, okay, that's an interesting story. No. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I've been doing it for so many years. There was a time before I started doing a lot of the corporate work when I first started performing, and we're talking 70s, when we had a gig in New Haven. It was like a magic night, and it was at like a comedy club. But it was like a magic night. It was more like one of those, Monday Night Magic or something that they have in New York City.
Yeah, New York City, right.
And so I performed at that a number of times, quite a few times. There were about 6 or 7 of us that used to sort of rotate. And so I used to do that, and that was a comedy club, but it was more of a magic night at the comedy club. But as far as just going into a comedy club and performing, I'll do that when it comes my way, which is not too often. But on that trip that you're talking about, and it's funny because I wrote about this in my late last book, the officer's manual, the professional mentalist officer's manual. Well, when I talk about some of the misconceptions people have, like people think that, oh, well, if you're good, you're going to get on TV. And that's not the way it works. You need a publicist, usually, to get on TV, unless you do something so newsworthy that, you know, it's news now and not just a guest appearance on some TV show. So unless you have a publicist, your chances of getting on any kind of major TV show are pretty small. That's not the way it works. And now, in this case, back then, we went on basically a tour, my manager and I. And we had a publicist back then, a renowned publicist. As a matter of fact, he was also the publicist for Michael Jackson. Yeah, you know, this guy had connections and could get you places and do things. And so it was sort of a fun trip. We worked our way, myself and my manager worked our way across the country, doing a lot of smaller clubs like that, like the one in Houston and some other clubs across the country, ending up with Live at the Improv in Hollywood. And then we went to the Magic Castle. So, you know, we, not to perform, but just, go there as a guest. But, and then we worked our way back, and then the last thing I did when we kind of got back to the East Coast was, we had just come back, and I was at a hotel, and I just woke up that morning, and my phone rang, and he said, you know, you're going to need Dustin Fox and Friends this morning, so get ready. And then an hour later, I was on Fox and Friends. So that's what a publicist does for you. But the thing is, you pay a publicist. You know, I mean, you're talking $1,000 plus a month to have the publicist. So
That's not just necessarily a percentage like you would think about paying an agent or something, but a publicist is something. I have heard other magicians who have given that kind of advice then too, Richard, that if you really want to amp up your persona, you want to be more well-known, that you really need to have a professional publicist who will have the contacts and put you in front of these people, and then it's up to you, I guess. You know, you have to have the personality and the act to be able to follow through with that. It's good advice to get someone who knows what they're doing.
Well, you know, I often bring up the great Buck Henry movie. The great Buck Howard movie, you know, which was sort of loosely based on Kreskin. There's a lot of
John
truth.
Malkovich,
right, and who played a great role. I've even written about it a couple of times in my books, saying, you know, if you want to know what a mentalist should look like, watch the movie and watch how a professional great actor plays the part of a mentalist, and then you understand what you should look like. Even though he was sort of playing the part of Kreskin, you could see the way he played that part. He was into it, you know. But anyway, if you recall, in the movie, he wanted to do the big stunt where he was going to hypnotize 50 people. And what did he do? He called the publicist to get together the press to cover the, you know, when the publicist falls in love with, you know, what's his name, is, you know, the guy in the road with him. Tom Hanks' son, you know, he makes the comment, you know, I'm the one who's paying for the publicist, you know. And that's true. That's how people like him get things done. If they want to go ahead and have some big stunt and want it promoted and what have you, they call a publicist. The publicist goes out and gets the press to come in, and that's how it works. And the same thing, you know, if you want to be in a guest on a TV show, unless, like I said, it's something really newsworthy that becomes news now and you get free publicity. But if you want to just be a guest on a show, chances are you're not going to get there without a publicist. So that's just how it works.
That's a good point, not only to have a publicist, but to think of that as someone who is going to be part of your working crew, if you will, because there are a lot of magicians who and mentalists who will think that, well, I can do it all. I can develop my own website because I put together my own show, my own act. I can book a show, the theater. I can make the contacts with the companies to go and do trade shows or whatever else, and do my own publicity and draw my own ads, et cetera. and do all the mail outs and whatever. But before long, by having your fingers in so many pies, you know, you really, even though that you kind of are a jack of all trades, you shouldn't be involving yourself in all those trades. I learned that from Mark Kalin many years ago, which he had said that he was doing all that, you know, and with Ginger, they were doing the choreography and everything. He said, you know, before long, you realize that let people who are professionals do their job, because as well as you think you can do it, they can do it better because that's their full-time profession. And they can do a good job of that. And so by having someone who is your personal manager or publicist, that they could do more for you than you can do for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as you know, we've been together, you know, where I've given seminars and things like that. And I always talk about how my inspiration for a lot of what I do comes from movies. I love movies. Now, I don't go to, I buy them, and then I can watch the extra features, because after I've watched the movie two or three times, if I really love it, then I watch the extra stuff, because that to me is the place you should create mentalism, you should create an act, and what have you. But the thing is, when you watch how they make a movie, you realize what you just said. Everybody has a role to play. They're the expert at that role, and that's it. The producer has one role, the director has another role, the assistant director has a role, this guy has a role, that guy's got a role, right down to the guys, you know, the gaffs and everybody else who is part of the whole picture. And there's hundreds of people, obviously. Likewise, with, you know, sure, there are some things that you can do yourself. And, of course, it also depends on the scale of your performing. I mean, if you're doing local shows and you basically drive to all the shows that you do, that's one thing. If, on the other hand, you're doing shows where you're flying to shows and doing corporate events and you want to do some things on TV, and maybe you're even after, you know, a special or something else, you have to have the people involved who know what they're doing, because you can't possibly do it all yourself.
Well, think of yourself, I guess, as being the chief executive officer of a company. You're the CEO and president, and so you wouldn't be doing it all. You have people who are vice presidents or presidents under you in this corporation, and they are doing their job, and you put them in charge of that, and if they're not, then you fire them. You get someone else who is going to be able to do it, and the same thing there. Again, if the publicist is not doing what you think they should, then go on with somebody else and who will be more effective. But the point is that you could and should hire people who would work for you and have your best interest in heart, and by paying them, they're getting something out of it.
Well, you know, and this all comes around to where I've been going over the last couple of years with a lot of my books that I've been writing and things that I teach in my seminar, and that's the story about what happens when all of a sudden you become a full-time professional performer. All of a sudden, it's a different ball game.
And, completely.
And, okay, most guys, and this, of course, is not to put down anybody. I you know, always want to start by saying that.
Preface that, sure.
There are a lot of guys, and they're great performers. There are guys who just occasionally do shows, and, you know, they almost do them for nothing because they're just fun, and they enjoy it, and what have you, and maybe from a charity event and stuff. Then you have a big bunch of people who, let's call them semi-pros. They have another full-time job. They still love performing, and they go out, and they try to do maybe, you know, two or three shows a month, and that could be anything. It could be little kids' birthday parties. It could be, you know, working at some restaurant, whatever. But they're a semi-pro, which means they have a regular job, and that's the job that pays all the bills, and this stuff is, like, extra. You know, it's more fun. It's like gravy. They don't count on the money to pay their bills and mortgage and what have you. But when you step into the field of full-time professional, now all of a sudden everything changes drastically. Mm-hmm. Because now it's your business. Now, and it's just not you. It's your family. You're supporting your family. And so now your whole outlook on the situation changes. And when I try to teach some of these things to magicians via the books or doing workshops and lectures, you know, I try to tread carefully because, again, I don't want to, like, insult anyone.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, it's a business, you know. And sometimes that can be harsh and cruel, and you have to be business-like about it, you know. Or you know, I tell a story, you know, like I was, you know, this is in one of my recent books where, you know, I'm working a trade show, and this guy who is just an amateur mentalist, actually a magician, who knows some mentalism, is, you know, talking to me and asking me questions. What kind of Swami gimmick do you use? You know, where do you do this? and while I'm doing the show. And, you know.
When there are people around who are your clients?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
And finally, you know, I managed to, you know, stay away from him until most of the people cleared out. He stood around, I guess, you know, everybody left. Yeah, you know, I'm one of the club, you know, I'm one of the guys, you know. And when no one else was around, you know, I kind of leaned over to him. I said, what do you do for a living? You know, and he told me what he did. I said, worked in an office somewhere, insurance company or whatever. I said, how would you like it if I walked into your office and did everything I could to get you fired? And make you look bad and get you fired. He kind of just looked at me, you know? And I told him, I said, how stupid can you be? And he was taken back and then kind of walked and left and never came back. But that's, now if that seems harsh, okay, but it's my business. What is wrong with you? You know, this is not, you know, to him it was a fun club thing, you know? To me, I'm there working my butt off. You know, how much work did I have to do to get the gig in the first place? How much work do I have to do to keep it and impress these people? And here's the guy who comes along, you know, and thinks, you know, he's in the ballpark, you know? And it's like, you know, if you know a little bit about home maintenance, you know, imagine what would happen if you walked in on a plumber doing his job and started telling him what to do. You know, or a construction guy outside building the house, and he walked up there and said, you shouldn't do it this way, you shouldn't do it that way. They'd grab you by the collar and just toss you out of there, you know.
And so
that's
well, I don't think that's unusual, Rich. I think that happens more often than you might think, in which that there are people who are working full-time, even, let's say, in a restaurant where some guy will come in and say, hey, there's already a magician working here, and they'll start working at some other tables and start showing some magic, or even go to the extreme of talking to the manager and saying, hey, you know, you need to hire me or consider me as helping this guy. It looks like he could use some more help. It looks like he got a lot of people here, and he can't get around to everybody, but I can do that or whatever. I mean, it can go to some crazy extremes.
And what do you say? I mean, you know, without, you know.
You have to have tough love sometime, I think, and take somebody, you know, by the figurative collar, not literally, but just kind of say, you know, listen, buddy, that I'm working here, basically. We can talk about this offline, but not in front of clients and customers and my boss, particularly like if you're a trade show or someplace. I think a lot of times the people are just trying to they don't know what they're doing necessarily as far as how much harm that it could do you, because to them, again, it is a hobby. And I agree with you. I want to tread lightly here. I'm not trying to put down anybody by any means. You had said, talked about the semi-professional. I like the term that is used by Gene Anderson, who had said the part-time professional. And there is a difference. I think if someone is semi-professional, it's kind of like you're halfway professional. It's like, you know, you're really not a complete professional, because if you're professional, then you're going to be a professional in every way, meaning you'll be doing it full-time, but also because of the way you conduct yourself. And you're not conducting yourself in a professional way if you are saying something to somebody like that, you know, and asking about some inside questions, or, you know, where you get this or that gimmick, and or I like that move or something, and you're saying that in a situation that everybody then realizes that, hey, this guy knows a little bit of something and he's trying to one up you, basically. But if you're a part-time professional, that means that you have another job you're doing full-time to pay the bills, as you say, and your insurance and mortgage, etc. But you're doing this on a part-time basis, but while you're there, you are a full-time professional in that part-time capacity, I guess, if you will. And so it's a way of looking at what you're doing in a more professional manner as opposed to a hobby. And again, there's nothing wrong as long as you know where you are within your pathway, and if your path is going to lead you to ultimately doing this on a full-time basis or not. This was something that, for my path, that it was. I always wanted to do magic on a full-time basis and was doing it on a part-time basis until I turned 55, and then retired early in order to pursue this on a full-time basis. So for a long number of years, I've been doing this full-time, and I full well appreciate what you're saying as far as what kinds of things that you need to prepare yourself for rather than jumping off the cliff. You need to make sure that your parachute is packed, basically.
Right, and there's things that you said as I was listening to you talk that I'd like to talk
elaborate
about a little
on.
More. Yeah,
okay.
And number one is, yes, a lot of what I teach now is aimed at people who may very well become full-time professionals, that's their goal, which is a lot of people. I mean, I get emails constantly from people who want to break into doing it full-time, and, of course, the only way you can do that is you have to start out part-time. In my case, it was kind of different because I was never had a real job. I went from playing drums to performing, so, I've always been, doing some kind of showbiz thing, I had a few little things on the side occasionally, but that was mostly always, I was performing, either playing drums or doing magic and mentalism. But most people, they start out doing part-time sales and love it and want to go and move into it full-time. So there's most people. So the advice here is to them as well, even if they're not full-time professionals as of yet. But the second thing is there are a lot of things that even if you never plan to become a full-time professional, you still should know better, or you still need instruction in. For instance, but the things that hurt magic in general, and I'm not just talking mentalism here, but just magic in general. For instance, one of my keys that I've had over the years, and I talk about this a lot, is when you're, let's say, a magician, and you're really into it. You're not a professional, but you really love magic. You buy the books and stuff.
It's a passion.
And somebody comes to you after, let's say, another guy performed, and, wow, that was really good. And the guys kind of knowingly shake their heads, yeah, of course. Worst thing in the world. It gets me so mad, is no, you never say that. That's the most worst thing, because what is it saying? It's saying, oh, yeah, we're one big club. All you got to do is be a member of the club, and you know how all this stuff works. There's nothing special about any one guy. I could step up there and do the same thing. It's terrible. The perception of magicians and mentalists and public eye is or should be, wow, there are very few of these guys in the whole world. These guys are special. And when somebody asks me, even if it's just the magician's doing something, and how he does that? It's like, I have no idea. Every one of us has our own things that we do, and they're like secret. Nobody else knows how we each do what we do. That the audiences love to hear that, and it does nothing but good for magic. Whereas the other way around, everybody knows how everything works. That's horrendous. Then it just completely strips the value of magic away. It makes it seem...
Takes away the mystery.
It takes away the mystery. Which leads to another point, too. This business of what you call yourself. Now I know that, I just call myself a mentalist because, that's, I've always used that term, ever since I began. Frankly, when I began, there weren't that many, so...
Well, and also, I would think that there'd be a misunderstanding that people wouldn't know what a mentalist is, so you have to actually explain what that is.
Well, I've always... See, my thing has always been, nobody ought to hire you because you're a mentalist. They ought to hire you because you're Scott Wells or Richard Oster.
Right.
They're hired. They're hiring you, the person. Because, again, let's get a mentalist, for this next show. Who are we going to get? Here's a tub full of mentalists. Pick them out. Now, that's not the way it should be,
That's true.
People should hire you any more than they should say, we need a singer, for our big show here. Let's hire a little grab Tony Bennett, because he's a singer. If we can't get him, we get another thing. You know, that, no, that's not how it works. You know, there's...
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Sometimes there are companies who will hire because they just want to have what I call the Muzak magician. There's someone in the background that's just kind of walking around doing something. I prefer for them to say, I want Scott Wells, because he can make sure that people are going to have fun, they're going to have good conversations, it's a good icebreaker, et cetera, or whatever, as far as the strolling goes, or that we enjoy him as an after-dinner performer. You're exactly right, that you want people to ask for you rather than, again, being just that generic plug-and-play magician or mentalist or entertainer.
Right. And so, as far as the term mentalist goes, it hardly ever comes up. I mean, you know, people just, when I get hired, that, you know, these are people I've worked for time and time again, you know, and they're hiring me because they know they can expect I'm going to come in and do a good job. Everyone's going to be happy. No one's going to get embarrassed, or I'm going to see a good time, and that's that. So the category of the performer doesn't mean nearly as much as knowing you're going to get a person who's going to do the kind of job you need done for your show.
Professional job, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So all this stuff is the kind of stuff I talk a lot about now in my lecture. You know, it's funny because I could go on for hours talking about all this, but on the other hand, I know guys sitting there want to see something too. You know, they want to see some routine, they want to see something new. So you have to, I'm sure you do the same thing when you lecture. You have to kind of balance off, you know, the practical advice with show and stuff too. So, you know, since over the last few years, I've been doing more lectures and seminars. I think I got it down pretty good. You know, I used to, sometimes I would talk too much. Luckily, Lisa always comes with me. You've been Lisa, my wife. And
mm-hmm. Yes, I have.
I monitor. If I start talking too much about theory and what have you, you know, she'll kind of give me
And that's easy to do, I think, to get spun off and talking about things that I think are the more important things, that is, of how to, the theoretical side of magic. But the things, however, that people typically will book a lecture is for the new gadgets or fun props or whatever it is that you have to sell that are going to be oftentimes moderately priced, or something that is so unique that they have to have it that may be high priced. But it, again, are the gadgets and the little things. And that's one of the things as far as mentalists go. Until just a few years ago, everything was pretty much organic, I guess, like with clipboards or whatever else. I mean, like that little Q&A thing that you had explained how to make, I think it was on an L&L video from way back when. I made up one of those things and it fiddled around with it for a while as well. I thought it was brilliantly made, a good idea. But nowadays, I would say over the past maybe 5 to 10 years, that they have gone into more electronic types of things where people can do remote reading and all kinds of things using thumpers or whatever else, all kinds of electronic devices. Like Pro Mystic makes the most fantastic things that seem to be built into something that looks very common and no one would ever suspect. So more of those things are kind of coming about. And since we're talking about that, what are your thoughts then, Richard, about using those kinds of things?
My thoughts are, I'm a traditional mentalist. I used to come across people, I would do something like, have somebody write something down, tear it up and tell them what they wrote down. They'd say, you know, that must be some kind of a special pen. That's a computer pen that sends the information to a computer. That's how you found out. And I would kind of laugh and say, if I could invent something like that, I wouldn't have to bother doing shows. I would just sell it and I would make a fortune. Now, of course, that's a reality. So my feeling is, why would you go someplace where before the technology even existed, people figured that's how it was done? So my own personal method of performing, and again, it's funny, last month or 2 months ago, they reviewed in Lincoln Ring magazine one of Kreskin's shows, and they made it a point that he offers a huge reward to anyone who can prove that he ever uses a Confederate or any kind of electronics, you know, Creskin.
And who was that? I'm sorry, you cut out on me when you said that.
Okay.
Who was featured?
Amazing Creskin.
Oh, Creskin. Pardon me, I didn't hear what you said. Yes, okay, go ahead.
He offers a reward, thousands of dollars to anyone who can prove he uses either Confederates or electrons.
Yes.
So he lumps those two things together into the same category. Now, I know, a lot of people I know use electronics. Close friends of mine do. We have discussions, let's say, about the whole thing. But for my own self, no, I prefer to be anti-technical when it comes to mentalism. As a matter of fact...
You're low-tech, basically.
No-tech. No-tech, yeah. Basically, my feelings are that... that the more miracles that we find on our iPhones, the more I tend to go towards pencil and paper and the most simple props imaginable.
Very true and very funny, because I've talked with people about that before as far as the iPhones, because oftentimes you'll do something with the phone and the first thing you'll say is, where'd you get that app? It's not like something you did, it's something that the app did, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I have one magic app on my iPhone that somebody developed, and they wanted me to try it out. And it's a very clever thing. I've used it a few times, and it's clever. But that's not me. That's just not me. I think with all the developments happening constantly in technology, I mean, how old are you, Scott? If you don't mind me asking.
64. Sure, okay. 64.
So you remember what it was like then compared to what it was like now.
I do.
People who are a little bit older like we are can see this incredible boom in technology over the last 20 years. I mean, I always say, it used to be that you could predict maybe what's going to happen in the future as far as what new inventions were going to come down the road. If you watch Star Trek and that kind of thing, you kind of almost could see it coming and say, yeah, one day they'll be able to do this, One day we won't need wires on phones. One day we won't need to get up and go to the TV to check the channel. That was like easy to predict, those kind of things. But now you can't even begin to predict some of the things that technology is doing. It's just mind-boggling. And so
especially how rapidly it's moving.
Yes, that's it. I mean, exponentially. I mean, it's not like every year it doubles. Every 2 weeks it doubles, it seems like.
Right.
So the more that happens, then the more I try to get away from anything that could possibly look that like it's any kind of a gizmo or whatever. And I know some of these things are very, very cleverly disguised, and you really can't. But you know what? The bottom line is, I look back and I say to myself, what can any of these things do that I can already do without them? Now, you mentioned when you came to that show that I was doing how you were really, you really liked the Q&A act I did.
Right.
Okay, to me, that's the ultimate mentalism. You're standing up there with a pad and pen in your hand, and you're reading the minds of the entire audience. You're thinking this, you're thinking that. What can be stronger than that? To me, that's the most powerful mentalism there is. And I can already do it. So why... this is my way of thinking now. And I'm not preaching to anyone. Do what you want. I'm just, telling you the way I think. I think I can already do that. So why, what at this point in my career, after 47 years, if I want to add anything to my show, I have to take something out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's gotten to the point, well, what do I want to take out of my show? What's better than what I'm already doing that I'm going to take it out of my show? And I have yet to see some kind of electronic gizmo that is going to fit that bill for me. I was, years ago we went to Blackpool, and one of the guys took me over to, and he had this, he knowing I'm a mentalist, he had this thing, I got to show it to you. And it was a chair. And the chair, when you sat in it, if you hit a button, it would thump your shoulder. So in other words, a way of doing PK touches electronically.
Right, yes.
So
you can be standing away without touching them, right, I understand.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, like, okay, but PK touches is already an incredible routine, all by itself. Danny Kipp's original PK touches is incredible.
As I recall, the thing that you're referring to, or at least the one I saw, it seemed like the guy took off his jacket, put it on the back of the chair, and then walked away. So in other words, it was something not with the chair, but with the jacket, I thought, or at least the one I saw.
Well, the one I saw was the chair, actually.
Was the chair itself? Okay. Yeah, it could be built in, I guess, too.
Because here's the thing about the chair cost, like, I forget how much, like $500 or whatever.
I'm thinking,
okay, you're going to show up at a gig and you're going to bring a chair?
Well, I guess if you're Del Rey,
what, you know,
your table.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, it's one thing if you're a musician or something, you know, these are like props and stuff. But, I mean, this is supposed to look like an ordinary chair. And you're going to get a guy up, sit down in the chair, and now, you know, this stuff is going to happen. And it's like, you brought a chair? We've got chairs. You see what I'm saying? Where is the logic in that? I mean, unless you cover it up. I mean, for me, I fly to just about every show I do. I'm going to fly a chair around the world where I perform.
That reminds me, as an aside, that someone had told a story about where they were using Los Sanders' floating table, and they took it into, they were doing a private home, a party someplace, and I guess the guy who owned the house or something, he set something on the table or was heavy enough that actually the table collapsed, and the magician just went off on him. And the guy looked at him, you know, because he was saying, I spent like $1,500 on, you know, this table, and he said, for that? He said, it's just balsa wood.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So why would you bring in a prop necessarily? It should be something that is already in and around you. That's why I like when you're doing magic, if you could do something in an impromptu method that with things that are just around you, if it's a paper napkin or that it's rubber bands, if it happens to be available. And so, but I like what you're saying is that you're doing things that are already there. Why would you, again, bring a chair? Unless you're doing a big stage show, but if you're going into someone's home or something, why bring something that they probably already have? No, that makes perfect sense.
Now, just to temper all this, because there are guys who make incredible electronic things. And like I said, I have friends who use that kind of stuff. And so who am I to tell anybody, don't do this or do this? You know, I'm just, you know, explaining my feelings in the matter. And, you know, I've seen some very, very clever devices. And, you know, some things, you know, like Chris's bell, this ring, stuff like that. It's amazing stuff, you know. And I'm not trying to, you know, to put down any of this stuff. I guess my barometer to measure all this stuff would be a few things. It would be, number one, you know, could you do this stuff without all the electronics? Because, you know, of course, the number one thing with electronics is they can fail. You know, you need things like batteries and good signals and everything else. I used to go to Ring 59 in New Haven, Connecticut when I first was got into magic. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, where I went for quite a few years. And, you know, things were a lot different back then. The guys were a lot different, older guys who really knew what was going on and taught me a lot of things and a lot of good advice. It probably still is that way now. But anyway, I haven't gone to a magic club meeting in a long time. And somebody said, you know, well, up in Cincinnati, we got a meeting in Sound Mentalism this month. And, you know, if you're not doing anything, you want to come up and maybe do something for the guys? And I said, sure, that'd be fun. So I went up there, you know, and I did something. But anyways, one of the guys got up and he did have one of these die things, you know, where you can, you know, I guess a number of people make them where somebody can, like, put whatever number up they want and cover it. And you know it because it's electronic, you know, it signals you somehow. And the guy came up and he was going to do this. And the problem with something like that is, okay, so, you know, what you just did, And again, you know, I talk about this stuff, you know, as far as like, what are you actually doing? You realize the effect in, you know, how it looks to a layperson. Basically, you're guessing one number out of six with a die like this, you know, which is okay, but it's not, it's a minor effect, you know. If you do it two or three times, I guess you increase the odds, you know, it looks harder. But, you know, it's not anything to compare to, like, when you name somebody's wife's name or dog's name or something like that. It's not even in the same category, but it's still an okay effect. So the guy decided he was going to do it, like, five times to prove that he could do it every single time. And he did it the first time and gave it to a woman in the audience who was not a magician, one of the guy's wives or something, and told her to take the die and you know, put it down on the table and cover it up, you know, and he was got the number right and wrote it down, you know, that's one, let's do it again. And he did it a second time and she chose another number. And he goes, he got the right thing, and she goes, what? And she had the die in her hand. She slammed it down on the table and said, how are you doing that? And the guy's face just dropped. He didn't say anything. But then I saw him kind of look off to the side, and he goes, you know what, I'm a little tired tonight. You know, I think I'm just going to stop here. You know, I got two out of two. Because she had busted the die. Now, the die is meant to be,
wow,
like, looks like a piece of wood. You know, I mean, yeah, really spent a lot of time and energy and money to make this thing look just like a piece of wood. So why would it match it down, you know, without thinking about it? You know, just wouldn't die. And there went the trick.
Right.
You know, other stories I've had about people, you know, all of a sudden they get somewhere and you know, I mean, how many times I go places and I want to check something in my email or something on my cell phone, there's no signal for some reason. I can't get a connection. Well,
that's right. Or of course, your battery dies or that the connection is interrupted by another radio frequency and the same frequency as yours or whatever. There are a variety of things that are happening. The same thing, I seem to recall Michael Amari used doing a floating bill trick. And I think when the invisible thread broke, it's like, what do you do? And he was on the Johnny Carson show.
You know. The first time he was on Carson, yeah. Carson had him on for the first time because Carson was mad at magicians because he wanted to get into the Magic Castle and they wouldn't let him in because he wasn't wearing a tie, and he got real mad and never had a magician on his show for years after that, even though up until then he had magicians all the time. And finally gets Michael Amar on, and Michael was going to do the floating bill and thread broke, which is why I never used thread. You know, that's why everything I do is like sturdy stuff that can't break.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Things that can't break, and
yeah.
That's like my son prefers to, instead of using a computer or anything that would keep a calendar that might get lost or destroyed or whatever, that he just keeps a pad of paper in his pocket, you know, and jots mm-hmm. down things that this is my calculator or my computer right here. This is my memory. So
yeah,
it reminds
sure.
me.
Yeah.
So
there's that old joke. He comes home, you know, one day from school or something, says, man, they got this amazing computer, you know, it doesn't need to be plugged in, you know. There's no screen. When you type, it goes directly onto the paper. It's amazing.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. Well, I kind of want to wrap up a little bit here, but I know that we've got coming up soon is going to be the East Coast Mind Jam, and you're going to be performing as well as doing a workshop. Now, when we were there a couple of years ago when they did the first Mind Jam, that you did both those also and had a pretty good turnout for that. Is this going to be a completely different? What did you do in the last workshop, and what are you going to be doing in this one?
Okay, well, it is going to be different, although I do have to say, you know, there are certain things that I've kind of become noted for that I think when people come to the workshop, you know.
Like a center chair?
Yeah, a center chair and, you know, bending some spoons and things of that nature. I think people expect that. And so, you know, if I didn't cover that, you know, I think I would be leaving some vital things out. But no, I am you know, putting together an entirely different workshop. So even if you've attended one before, it's going to be different, you know. And again, a lot of this will be more along the lines of what I've been working on recently with my two field manuals, you know, talking about what true professional performing is all about and the kind of things that you really have to know if you plan to do this, you know, for a living, and the kind of things that can make and break your career. So a lot of that.
You and Jim Sisti had put out several PDFs. Is that what you're talking about, those kinds of manuals that you can download kind of a thing?
No, well, we stopped actually doing any kind of downloadable material many, many years ago. Some of our first books were some of the first downloadable PDFs years and years ago.
Sure.
But then I decided I didn't want my material as widely distributed as has been in the past. And so now we only, you know, sell things through our own website. So whatever I have at the East Coast Mind Jam is stuff that you can only get from us. You can't download it. It's hard. It's real books. It's not PDFs.
Okay.
These are, you know, 100-plus page books that real books, you know, with paper and covers and that kind of thing. And we've had two recently. One was called the Professional Mentalist Field Manual, and the new one that we just came out with a few weeks ago was the Professional Mentalist Officer's Manual. And it's filled with advice about, you know, how not to have stage fright, you know, the real nitty-gritty stuff about performing, stuff that nobody else, you know, I try to hit on topics that, you know, have not been discussed widely in the past, you know, and what I found works. Things, you know, best things about contracts and writers, you know, and how to conduct yourself in a corporate environment, what's right, what's wrong, how to avoid this kind of problem and that kind of problem. All these things that I've learned over the course of my career that a lot of times I make big, huge mistakes with, that have cost me, you know, dearly, that, you know, I don't want others to have happen to them. So a lot
people
of
people can benefit from the experience that you've had over the last 40 plus years.
That's the whole goal, you know. This is what I've learned, you know, to do and not do, and just want to pass it on to you. So that, in conjunction with the fact that, you know, look at, we've had, you know, I think I've got more mentalism DVDs than anyone now. I mean,
how many do you think you have?
Okay, we started off, you know, with the Mind Mystery series. That was 7 altogether. And then there was Easy to Master. There was No Camera Tricks, which I wanted to show how mentalism could look on TV without using any camera tricks or stooges or anything like that. There was Live Without a Net, a show in Reno. There was the Corinda, you know, Steps. There was the Animan series, you know, that was 6 things. I did Sapphire Collection a few years ago, that I did Intermittent Possibilities. This last year we did a DVD called Eerie. I did a DVD with a friend of mine in France where on billet work that we filmed in front of Notre Dame Cathedral. I did a 13 Steps series with Penguin Magic, plus, you know, the lectures, 3 lectures, 2 of my own and 1 with Cassidy. A lot of DVDs, a whole lot.
didn't I hear, I think one of your Penguin lectures is kind of famous. It was like 4 hours long or something?
Actually, 5 hours, 5.5 hours. It was crazy. It wasn't done on purpose. You know, what happened was, you know, I tend to just can go on and on forever if nobody's there to ring me in, and that's usually Lisa. But on this night when we went to do the lecture, Lisa wasn't feeling well, and after we got there, she said, you know, I really don't think I'm going to make it through the night. So the hotel was not far away, so I took her back there and came back. I knew she'd be sleeping, and so I never paid attention to the time, and it just kept going on and on and on and on until finally... Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy long. I don't know if it was the longest, right, but certainly it was one of the longest. So, yeah, I'll have copies of that with me. You know, I have some of the DVDs with me at the Mind Jam, which I'm sure it's going to be great. Yeah, looking forward to it.
You had done a lot of things with Louis Falanga there at LNL. Do you still do some things with him? Again, you mentioned Penguin and the Ferenc thing.
Yeah, no,
that,
Louis has stopped doing... DVDs, you know, now, you know, he just basically sells what's already been done. Mm-hmm. So there are no more
packaging them. Yeah.
He has the World's Magic stuff, you know, where he'll take
best
like
stuff or whatever. Yeah.
But as far as recording, no, he's not recording anymore. It hasn't been for many years. Yeah, that's a thing in the past. And actually, yeah. I kind of like what we're doing now because we have a lot more control. Like I said, a few years ago, Jim and I said, you know, we're going to do our own DVDs. We did the Corinda set we did with L1L, and that was, actually pretty complicated to get all the rights to that and everything, you know, from everything from Corinda to the people who own the books and who own the copyright to the cover of the book and the English owners and American owners. Whereas Anim and Spectrumental Effects, that's public domain. That's right. Why you see it as the Dobrin book. So that's the first one we attacked, because we figured if we did Corinda, well, a good follow would be to do the Anim and series. So we did that. But then after we did that, then I always try to come up with different themes. The Sapphire Collection was because of my 45 years involved in magic mentalism, so that was a collection of all original material. Then Intimate Possibilities was mentalism for up-close work. A lot of it is cards, but there's other stuff, too, that's not cards. And I even had the contact mind reading demonstration on there that kind of goes along with the book I just wrote. And then we did Eerie. This last year, I always wanted to do a DVD that was kind of spooky and that did some kind of spooky type effects. It's not a ghost show thing by any means, but it's just putting a certain element of creepiness into some of the mentalism.
Right. More story related.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was a lot of fun. We did that, and that turned out to work out real well. A lot of people love that, too. So, yeah, I've had a lot of them. You know, I probably have left out some of them, as a matter of fact, that I've forgotten. But, yeah, and of course, that's not even talking about the original Challenge Magic that I did, you know, forever long ago. That was one of my first DVDs back in the 80s that I did that one. So, yeah, there's a lot of DVDs that I've done.
I was going to say, as we really start to wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. So I want to close just by asking you what it is that's important to you. What is it that's your philosophy of life? It doesn't have to be a word. It could be a phrase, something that you live by, something that's important to you. So what's your magic word?
The most important thing to me is the ability to give. And when it comes to magic and mentalism, I always try to teach in my lectures and my workshops that you're giving people when you perform. If you truly are an artist and you truly believe in what you're doing, you're giving them something that they can't get anywhere else. With magic, you're giving them true mystery. You're showing them something. I always like to say, you know, that magic is the art of the creation of mystery. Nothing else, no other art form seeks to do that. And when, as a true performer, what you should strive to do is give people true mystery. So they'll walk away from your show enthralled, delighted, having had a wonderful time, and will see things that they will talk about the rest of their life and help people about. And if you can do that and give them something to take away with them, then you've given something that no one else can give. Because the greatest thing we can all do is to give to other people. And as magicians, as mentalists, we are in the unique position of being able to give things that are truly different than what anyone else can give.
Very good point.
That's how I myself.
So be giving. Person. Perfect. Well, good. Richard, thank you very much. I appreciate you being a guest here today.
Okay, Scott, I look forward to seeing you in just a few weeks. I'm sure Mind Jam is going to be a wonderful event. You know, we had a great time last time and even better hotel, and I'm sure that, you know, it's going to be fun seeing Mark and all the rest of the guys. We're going to have just a wonderful time.
Right. It will be. So thank you very much again for the Magic Word Podcast. That was Richard Osterlin, and this is Scotty out. I want to again thank Richard Osterlin for taking the time and being my guest this week here on The Magic Word, and also for the gift that he is going to be providing one lucky listener. If you will go to themagicwordpodcast.com and scroll to the bottom of the blog, you will see a place where you can enter your name and email address, and by doing that, you're entered into the contest in which he's going to be giving away a copy of his new 2-DVD set called Eerie. But now it's time to announce the two winners from last week's contest for the free copy of the PDF lecture notes, Creating the Paranormal Experience by Jamie Salinas and myself. And the winners are Magister Freud and Daniel Norat. Congratulations, guys. Those PDFs will be sent out to your email addresses that you provided when you entered the contest. And for those of you who didn't win, the PDF is available on the website at themagicwordpodcast.com. Just click on the link to the left over here on the website that says Scott's Lecture Notes, and you'll see that link to the PDF of Creating the Paranormal Experience. And I think that's pretty much a wrap for this week. So until next time, stay well, get booked, and give something to your audience. This is Scotty out.